Good morning, everybody. So it is wonderful to be learning together. Today we're going to be learning about the topic is the importance of our environment. This could be understood in many different ways, but we're going to focus on one of those ways. Before starting, I'd like to thank Jack and Barbara Siegel, who are sponsoring today's share in memory of Jack's father, Mr. Sigmund Siegel Alexander Zisha Ben Yechiel Halevi Alav Shalom, and Jack's mother, Anna Siegel, Chana Rachel Bas Moshe. Jack, if I'm not mistaken, you said one of the yahrzeits is today.
Today is my father's.
Today's your father's yahrzeit. Hashem. Oh wow! So it's really at this stage. Be'ezras Hashem for your continued learning in the family and by yourself and Barbara and everybody together should be a continued alias neshama for them. And thank you for making this opportunity to learn for them. So, folks, what is the importance of our environment? So this is not an environmental issue. This is not about government policy and regulations. This is not about Keystone pipelines. This is about our personal environment. So I'd like to develop this idea together, which I find to be a very intriguing idea over the last few days that I came across. And it is an idea lab, which means to say it is not finished yet. It's not fully reached its fruition. I'd like to put it out there to discuss as we go a little further. Here we go. So let's jump straight in. So it starts off with the discussion about Jerusalem. Yerushalayim is a very special place, and even today there are customs unique only to Yerushalayim. Anybody recognize any customs unique just to Yerushalayim? Okay, so starting Shabbos at 40 minutes before Shkia. That's one minhag of Yerushalayim today. There are many minhagim of Yerushalayim which are also different. So, for instance, here's an interesting one: is if you were to be in a place where there is no Sefer Torah for Tachanun, as an example, you would not be able to put your head down for Tachanun, what's called Nefilas Apayim, outside of Yerushalayim. But in Yerushalayim, you would always do Nefilas Apayim even in the absence of a Sefer Torah. There are lots of interesting things. There's lots of practices in terms of the limits of bans, as an example, and there's certain rules about how you use a ban, but the style of weddings. But there are also sort of holy ideas which reflect the uniqueness of Yerushalayim. Here is one of them, and it relates to yesterday's parasha, Kiseitse. The Tosefta is an addition. So it's an additional Tanakhic work that Rabbi Chiya had to augment the Mishnah. So there's the teachings of the Mishnah with a few extensions. So Tosefta Nagaim tells us, the very beginning, Rabbi Nazan Omer, Af Ein Ba Mishum Ben Sorer Umoreh. There was no wayward or rebellious son in Jerusalem. That doesn't mean to say that all the children were well behaved. What that means is that you would not prosecute a ben sorer umoreh in Yerushalayim. So let's clarify again. Here you have a child who is growing up, a delinquent, a man. It doesn't seem to be a problem on the woman's side as much. You have a young man who's acting out in a particular way, starting gluttony, drunkenness, really starting to steal to support the habits. We know that this child's on a pathway of terrible negativity. And so the Torah says, Yomos Zakav al Yomos Chayav, is the understanding, the tradition that we have, that this child is, so to speak, eliminated before they can get to a much more serious degree of depravity. And, you know, sort of put the parallel today, in those days, the substances that we're looking at was meat and wine. And you can put today, the child peddling fentanyl on the street corners, or he's stealing. You know what I'm saying? That's the parallel of where we are. So it's going to be a very complicated life. We know that it's probably going to lead to all kinds of difficult things in the future. That's what the Torah says. Very troubling in general, because can you have a child beyond the point of no return? The Gemara tells us that there never really was one, according to most opinions, indicating that there is never a child really beyond the point of no return. But be it as it may, you would not be able to prosecute such a child in Yerushalayim. That's the rule. And the question is okay, why? what's unique about Yerushalayim that you can't prosecute such a child? Yerushalayim is a big metropolis. It's a lot of folks living out there, certainly in the good day. So what's special about Yerushalayim? That's the question we're going to put on the board at the back. Hold on to that for a second. We now come to Gomorrah, which I find is so fascinating. This Gomorrah is incredibly unique. By the way, folks, I did, if anybody needs, I did just print a few extras. If anybody wants to pick them up in the office, I apologize. I think we just ran out of our sources. So the So the Gemara is a Gemara in Bava Basra, and it's talking about the halachas of shutvim. Shutvim means neighbors. Now, I find it so fascinating. This area of halacha, I think, is the true test of character. Because, you know, it's all very nice, you know, like our dealings with people when we're in the places we choose to put to be. You know, we go out there in the world and we show a certain face and we deal with people in shul and in work. And these are places where we go out to. But how do you deal back home with the person who's next door and the level of the music and the activities in the yard and how I'm building and all those kind of things and the drainage I'm taking away from my neighbor? That's where the real rubber hits the, you know, it hits the road of like who we are, is how we deal with our neighbors. And there's a whole body of halacha dedicated to the halachas of shutvin. In fact, a lot of the Bava Basra deals with that, certainly at the very beginning, and here is another example of it, where there's certain activities which we have not or cannot do because of that, because of our neighborly concern. So Rabbi Yochanan is talking about certain activities which you are allowed to stop. So the Gemara says, "Omer Rabbi Yochanan, Mishum Rabbi Bina, Bakol Hashutvin Akvin Ze. In all activities, the shutaf, a partner, can prevent the other partner from doing. So, for instance, let's say we have two apartments opening up onto a shared space. We have a yard, which we both have. So I can tell you, who is my neighbor, who shares the space with me, you're not allowed to put a kiln there. You're not allowed to start making pottery. Why not? Let's say as an example. What would be the concern for me? What was that? As it could be dangerous, it could be hot, it could be smelly. There's all kinds of things that come with the activity that you're doing. It's infringing upon my, so to speak, rights of usage of that area, right? So the Rabbi Yochanan says that there's a sensitivity. You can't do something which the other person sharing the space wouldn't be happy with. Makes sense, right? It's going down to the lowest common denominator. Going to the highest numerator, actually. The Rabbi Yochanan says there's an exception to this. Except for laundry. So laundry over there is not the laundry we talk about today. You know, like today, you know, you go to the machine. Thank you so much. You go to the machine and you press the button and the machine makes a little tune, you know, and then 39 minutes later it makes another tune and then suddenly are you ready to go. That's not the laundry that the Gemara is talking about over here. We're talking about the good old, you know, you get a bucket from the river, right? You put the clothes in it and you scrub it with whatever ash or soap the substance that you possibly have, and you wring it out and you do it again, and then you do it again, and you rinse it again after three buckets and three trips to the river, and then you hang it up, right? So that's you are not allowed to tell your neighbor you can't do this in the yard. That is always seen as an activity which is allowed. Why? This is a spiritual regulation. Because you don't want to force the daughters of Israel to become embarrassed about laundry. What does that mean? The Rashbam says is that let's say that the neighbor A says to neighbor B, you can't do laundry in the yard. I don't like it. It's not nice. There's water everywhere. There's sponge. It's coming over the edge of my doorstep. And, you know, and in Israel, you're like walking along the sidewalk and suddenly, you know. But so I don't like all of this. So the person doing the laundry, let's say the lady who lives next door, what's she going to have to do? She's going to have to do it publicly. What does it mean, public laundry? Not the laundromat. What does that mean? That means the river, right? So she's going to have to take all the clothes. Instead of bringing the bucket up to the yard, she's going to go down to the river, and she's going to have to do laundry. Now, just a little secret. To do that, it's not so easy, because that means you have to get into the river, right? So she has to roll up her skirt, and she has to go into the river. The sages said, we don't want to force the woman doing laundry to be in a setting where they have to themselves be disgraced or immodest in a public setting. Now, by the way, Rabbeinu Shmuel, the Rashbam, says this is only a halacha which is extant in a place where the women do the laundry. But where the men do the laundry, then you can say not. So I wanted to ask the Rashbam, where is it that the men do the laundry? And it should be, but he's saying this is specifically unique to the place that this is the role over here. The Rashbam says it wasn't necessarily gender-specific role. But nonetheless, in a place that it is, this is where it comes up. So this is a halacha in Shutvin, which relates to a regulation that the Chachamim made as to where laundry can be or cannot be done. Now here's the fascinating thing. The Gemara asks a question, which is a question which oftentimes I'm discussing with my wife. This question comes up, but the Gemara identifies a particular sensitivity. The Gemara now quotes a pasuk in Yeshayahu, in Perek Lamed Gimel, which talks about those who will see the return to Zion. Those are going to come back to Geula, and there's a number of descriptions of that person, that we'll call personality set, And one of them is, the person who closes their eyes from seeing the things that they shouldn't. What kind of person is that? It's like lauding this person. This is a person who's doing a great thing. What's that kind of person? Who's the person who's oitzem enov meroiz bara? Person who doesn't open his eyes when watching the laundry unfolding as well, which is going on in the river. So we're talking about a person who would usually be walking along the riverbank and close their eyes. The Gemara says, hey Chidami, what kind of situation are we talking about? Now notice that the sensitivity of the Gemara is Rosemary. I've got to find it for you over here. What's fascinating is that the Gemara is essentially bringing up is the topic which is the other side of the coin, which is it's all very nice to say that to protect the women's rights and say that they have to be careful where they're doing the laundry and so to speak, but what about the men? Right? So don't the men bear any responsibility about where they are gazing or looking? Right? So which is an important question. You know, in seminary, A lot of times the discussion with the young ladies is modesty. With the men, the discussion is not modesty. The discussion is what's called shmiras anayim, about where we look or where we don't look. So just understand there's two sides of that coin. There's two different departments over here in terms of preserving this. So the Gemara is saying, how does this work? Well, the Gemara is asking, hey Chidami, what kind of situation are we talking about that this is the case? So the Gemara says, id ikar darko achrina. Let's say that there are two roads to get to town. So road number one is past the river route. And road number two is called the ridge route, right, over the top of the mountain, right? So let's say that there's two routes, and this fellow decides that he's going to take the laundry route, right? Okay, so he's going to take the more scenic route. So in this case, Roshahu says the Gemara. That's an evil person. That's not let's say that person goes there and then he averts his eyes. The Gemara says that's a rasha. That's not a good person. So then it says, the only way to get to town is the river route. That's where the pathway is. He says, Anasu, if that person is not able to stir to avert their eyes from looking at the women who are doing the laundry, that person is an honest, that is beyond their capacity of control. So the Gemara says, there is no other way. A person should be walking without looking really so well because he should be trying as best as he could. And that's the type of person who's being lauded, who's being praised by Yeshayahu as to see the redemption, is that kind of person. Now let's just see think about this for a second. So the Gemara, the context, the milieu of this discussion is morality, right? And the responsibility of the morality upon a man in terms of where they're seeing, where they're not seeing. But here's the interesting thing. Let's ask this question: what happens if there is a person who decides to take route B? It's the river route or the highway route, right? And he takes the river route, and then he tries very hard not to gaze in the direction of the river as he's walking there. But he slips up. He can't. He's got about a trip over a tree root. He opens his eyes, and all the women are doing laundry. So at that point in time, is that person culpable? He was tripping over a tree limb. Is that person culpable for an immoral infringement by seeing the women who are doing the laundry?
Of course he is.
So on the one hand, you say, well, wait a second, but he just tripped over a tree limb, so that he had to open his eyes, yeah? So that's what the Gemara is saying is, Rashahu means to say, it's not about what happens along the route. It's the fact that he put himself on the route, right? The choice that he's being held culpable for was not what happens along the way, but the fact that he put himself on the way in the first place. That's what the Gemara is essentially saying. That's a very terrifying idea. That helps us understand this idea about the Ben Sora Mora. Let's appreciate this. Here we have a child who's getting into drunkenness, gluttony, thievery, already at a very early age. Says the Meshech Chachma, Rav Meir Simcha Devinz, I came across this just last week, and he says a very, I would say, startling statement. He says in the third source, Ulefiza, I'm skipping just the first line. Gam Yerushalayim hayatoida u'shlamim u'maaser sheni. In Jerusalem, There were all kinds of food, right? Because people bring korbanos, and a lot of that meat, the holy meat, would be eaten in Jerusalem. A lot of the products that would be brought to Yerushalayim would be eaten there. The chatzeros Yerushalayim bedukos mishum noisar. And people will be especially careful not to leave over any meat, not to leave over anything which should have been eaten as a korban till after its time. Quoting Yerushalmi, v'havi oichlin basar harbe v'yayin ma'aser sheni, and they would have to eat much meat and then lots of ma'aser sheni products, which like wine, like the grapes would be brought up from the villages and the farms. Lachain ein chait. You cannot blame a young man for a bad habit in such an environment. Now, think about this for a second. This is such a shocking statement. Because what essentially the Gemara is saying is like this. Is it a good thing or a bad thing that there's lots of meat and wine in Jerusalem? Is it a good or bad thing? That's a good thing. Korbanos, and in fact, the fact that they were eating so much meat and drinking so much wine was as a function that they were being careful not to leave over what noisar, so that there should not be any leftover meat of the korbanos, which would have to be burnt, right? So that's all good. But the byproduct of good could mean to say that children, young juvenile delinquents, cannot be held responsible for their activities in the same way in that environment. That has lots of ramifications on Jewish society, that statement, for a moment. There are so many good things that we make, so many incredible amenities that we make in our sophisticated, advanced Jewish communities. And they're so good. But all good and all haves comes with a little bit of a shadow. And it has a ramification on education. It has a ramification on the types of children that we bring up as well. That's what the Mishnah Chachma is saying. Yerushalayim, the holiest of holies, the best of the best, the most wonderful city replete with all of this. Has a negative side to it. It's something which should cause this, should give us a little bit of a pause in terms of the environments that we create as well.
Liberals call this sociologically challenged. It's almost like this
right.
this potential that's sort of moment can't help it.
And what's fascinating is that according to the Mishnah Chachma, the Tosefta is already grappling with that issue, which is not a new issue. It's not a new sociological issue which we're talking about, but it reflects environments.
Affluenza.
Oh. There we go. Yes, and that's what it is. And as a product of good intentions, as a product of good societies that we create. Yes.
Why would it be that we would make this minhag only in Yerushalayim when the same thing may be analogously said? Maybe there are arcade games in Tiberia. There are. Beaches.
You're right. There's lots of other activities going around in Israel, but in the end of the day, Yerushalayim happened to be with lots of meat and wine, and that was the activity that this particular boy is caught up in. But yes, and there's no other city that has the halachas of Noisar and Kotshim Kalim like Yerushalayim. But yes, but maybe one would have to extend that idea to other places as well in other activities. But
so
be a bit as
also the question would be anthropologically, perhaps or historically, why wouldn't Chazal have done that in any case? What was it in particular in this case?
There's a tradition that the Tosefta has that a child could not be prosecuted in this environment. And the reason for not being prosecuted in that environment is because part and parcel of Jerusalem is a lot of eating and drinking in a good way. That's all they're saying. That's a tradition. Could we extend that elsewhere? Possibly. And possibly here even, yeah.
Is it only Kohanim that eat?
No. Kochim Kalim. I bring a shlomim. I get a whole section of that animal to eat, and I have to eat it in a certain amount of time. A toda, I have all these loaves. Maaser sheni. This is regular people. Which, by the way, is just fascinating as to why that is. Why? What's the halach of maaser sheni? The Rambam talks about this more. Nevuchim, just interesting. So that you mentioned it. The Rambam says it's for the regular populace to be in a good environment, in a holy environment when they're recognizing Hashem. Meaning, I'm not even giving it away. Maaser sheni. It's mine. But I'm eating it in this holy environment. So Torah wants us to be in this environment, and it's a good environment. Nonetheless, there's lots of wine at the table, and the kids are seeing that's the outcome of this. I want to take it one step further here. So just to appreciate this is how far this goes. The Rambam talks about this in Halacha. The Rambam writes 14 books about halacha, and not all of them are just about the spoon and the meat and the dairy and that's one area of halacha. But he has a whole section of halacha called deos. Do you know how do you translate deos? Knowledge is one way, but usually characteristics. So it's how to live a wholesome life. The Rambam has a whole book called Deos, very worthwhile learning and appreciating. Some of it is based on certain ideas, Aristotelian ideas of the time, just to appreciate that, the golden mean and so on. But be it as it may, the Rambam talks about characteristics. In the sixth perek, he says the importance, a significant observation here. He says, Derech b'riyasai shel Adam, shel Adam, niyos, nimshach b'deyosov v'ma'asov achar re'ov v'chavirov. It is the way of a human being to be drawn after their friends and their surroundings, v'noheg k'minag anshei medinasai, and to act like the way the people around us act. V'chach tzorech Adam l'izchaber l'tzadikim v'leishev etzel hachachomim tamid k'dei shi'il m'maseh. So make a good choice as to who your neighbors are. Make sure that the people who are influencing your action patterns are the kind of people you want to look a little more like, right? And try to avoid those who have bad action patterns because you'll learn from them. The Rambam goes on so far as to say that let's say you are in an environment where you can't change. You happen to be in a neighborhood, a locale, and the people live a morally corrupt life. So you need to move, says the Rambam. Move to a different neighborhood. That's what the Rambam's observation is. He says, and then, if you cannot move, he says, maybe even a gayasos, because militarily there's a crisis, or because there's a choli, there's some sort of pandemic going on, which prevents you from moving around, says the Rambam towards the end over here. He says the following. He says, Yeshev levadoi yechidi. You must stay by yourself, or Yetzei lama'aros velachavochim, go camp outside community rather than being influenced by that society. That's how far the Rambam understands our influence. Because, let's talk about education for a moment, right? So I'll say there's really four partners in education. And that is, of course, the parents and of course, the school, right? Those are the two most obvious entities. We sometimes forget about the Almighty. Ribbono Shel Olam is part of the education, like part of the creation. We have to do a lot of davening as part of the education process. And there's also the fourth entity is the friends and their families, which means that as much as we may talk about certain ideas, if our kids and grandkids are going to school and they're hearing about certain other ideas and that becomes the thing, that's going to be the thing they want, right? The shoes they want to wear and the places they want to go is going to be influenced by that crowd, which means, let's think about this for a second, part of the educational process is choosing the environment that they're in as well. Because you're essentially choosing the families you want your child to be educated by. Yes?
Isn't that reason the past 15 years so many Shomer Shabbos families around the country have turned to homeschooling?
I don't know. I can't talk about it. Larger policies and so on. There's a general trend in general in society around us which we're being influenced by. Another example of assimilation to the culture around us about homeschooling. But I can't comment on that one. But I can comment on the following. Sometimes what this makes you feel is it makes you say, wait a second, is this taking free choice away from us? I mean, in a certain sense, it's almost like saying that, I've got no choice, right? The friends are going to say such and the friends are going to be interested in that. And the answer is no. Where is the free choice exercise for the most part?
To decide to extricate from the environment.
Which path am I taking? Which path am I putting myself or my children, my grandchildren on in the first place is going to be a major influence upon the way they're going to act because we like to normalize. Here's the way I was thinking about it. In chemistry, let's say I have a bath of hot water and I take a little bit of cold water, I take a cup of cold water and I put it into the hot water. So there's a chemical equation which can be done for all liquids, right? As to the exchange of heat, right? So I can measure it. The equation has a constant for which type of liquid we're talking about. And then there it depends on the volume of the volume and the temperature of the entity that it's entering and the entity that it is entering, and you can work out the heat exchange. Most people always think that and focus on the fact that the cold water will become warm or warmer. What we don't think about is that the hot water also becomes a little colder, right? That's the heat exchange. It goes both directions, right? So the environment you put yourself in is going to influence you and vice versa. It goes both ways. So much so that there's a book which I think its title is kind of self-explanatory, if you know what I'm saying. It's called Willpower Doesn't Work, so by Benjamin Hardy. So just a little excerpt from his introduction, I think it's a really fascinating observation. He says, you are who you are because of your environment. Want to change, then change your environment. Stop the willpower madness already. Right? These ideas run counter to a lot of self-help advice, which tends to focus on what you can do by yourself and yourself. The pervasive self-help advice is focused on yourself. This makes sense because we live in a highly individualistic culture. We've been conditioned to ignore the context and obsess about ourselves. Environmental design is different. It's about creating conditions that make your success inevitable. For example, if you want to be focused at work, you need to remove all distractions from your physical and digital workspace. If you want to eat healthy, remove all unhealthy foods from your house. If you want to get a creative insights, get out of town and relax for a day or two. If you want to be more motivated, take on a greater responsibility and increase the stakes for both success or failure. Doesn't mean to say you can't make the right good decisions in the absence of these. No, you can, but it's harder. And when we're in cruise control, when we're in habituated thinking, where we're caught in full sensitivity, which is not the way we live most of the time. We're living a certain habituation. We are going to follow what's in our environment. So therefore, suggests the author, in this case, Benjamin Hardy, that it is best to change the environment in order to influence the outcomes over here, which is what the Gemara was saying. The blame for a person walking by the river is not to be held about what happens by the river in the case where the milieu is morality. It's about choosing to be by the river in the first place. It's about the Yerushalayim. There's a very positive aspect of being in Jerusalem. It's a wonderful and holy place. But it has this element to it, which is a place of plenty. And a place of plenty breeds a certain element there of the affluenza, which comes by it as well. So where is the choice? Where are we held culpable for? Is the choice of where we go in the first place more than what we do in that place, because that is harder to do. We have these epiphany moments. You know, we have these grand moments of, you know, we go to shul, we're at Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, we have these grand moments, and those are all wonderful. But what happens on an average Shabbos afternoon, right? Who are we hanging out with? Who are our kids hanging out with? What are the conversations? Those in between times is where influence happens, and where influence happens is the decision we need to make beforehand. I find this fascinating when it comes to people choosing houses, you know? How much time is given when people think about buying houses as to who the neighbors will be? It's not so easy because we're trying to find the prices right and we're trying to find certain amenities that are nearby. But how many times are we thinking about who's going to be hanging out with us and our family on an average Sunday or Shabbos afternoon, right? How much thought is given to who will be the influences upon our lives and the norm? And thank God, many of us are so lucky and blessed. But was that ever a thought process? Like, was that ever part of the decision-making process in terms of houses? Now, houses is a big one, but there's smaller things. Which trains we take, where we find ourselves, which minyanim we go to. All these kind of things are environments that we're choosing for ourselves as well. You know, in 1978, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks talks about, this is, I don't know if anybody had the opportunity of being at the Kinnas HaShluchim in 2011. Anybody was at the Chabad Kinnas HaShluchim 2011? No, okay. Yossi, no? No? Eliezer, no? So Jonathan Sacks was the keynote speaker at the time, and he spoke about his relationship with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So I came to America in 1978 as a college student at the time. He was in Cambridge, and he came and he wanted to meet a number of people, and he got to meet Rav Soloveitchik. He met and he wanted to meet the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So he came to 770, and on Eastern Parkway, he turns to a Chabad Chassid and he says, "I'd like to meet the Lubavitcher Rebbe." And the man starts laughing. He says, "Of course, get in line." You know, he says, "There's no way you could just walk into 770 at this time, even in the 70s, and just get a meeting, right?" So he says, "Well, you know, I've traveled from very far. I'd really like an opportunity." So he left his number of his aunt who lived in California, to just in case an opening was found. So off he goes. A week later, he gets a call on a Motzei Shabbos that the Lubavitcher Rebbe will be able to see him on Thursday evening. So that's what he does. He gets into a Greyhound. Anybody had the opportunity of spending time in Greyhounds? I did many Greyhounds in this country. That's how the Hamonam travels in America. Any guesses how long it took? Just LA.
72 hours.
72 hours. Excellent. Good. Good. So 72 hours across country was not the RV experience, you know. He gets to New York. He comes to the Lubavitcher Rebbe and he's asking the Lubavitcher Rebbe about what to, you know, he's got questions about where he should go in life, what he should be doing, and so on. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe turns the tables and starts asking him, like, "So tell me, how many Jews are on campus? How many of them are affiliated? How many of them are Shomer Torah Mitzvot? What amenities are available to them? What are you doing to..." And he wasn't ready for the interview. He was expecting to get some advice. He wasn't expecting to be interrogated. So So he starts, you know, fumbling, and he says, in the situation that I find myself, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe cuts him off. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe says to him a sentence, Rabbi Sacks says changed the rest of his life. And the sentence was the following. He says, no one finds himself in a specific situation. You got yourself into a certain situation, and you can put yourself into another situation. You are in charge of the place you put yourself into. And I think about it so much. We talk the language of passivity and of victimhood. So much time we spend talking about where we are found and the place we're in, and as if we are a victim of that circumstance. And we're right. In that circumstance, we are a victim. But how about talking the proactive decision maker who's chosen about that environment? So I always remember this. I always reflect on this myself. In Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, talks about when he was teaching a graduate level degree, and one of his students, a young lady, says that she cannot come to the thing because she has to go to tennis practice for the playoffs. If she doesn't go, they're going to kick off the team, and this is serious games now. So he says to her, "That's not true." So she says, "No, it is." And she pulls out the schedule and she shows that there's a conflict in the schedule. She says, no, what's not true is you don't have to go. Well, the truth is that you have a conflict on your schedule and you chose that this is more important than my class. That's fine, but be honest about it. We like to choose language of victimhood is I have to, because it makes it easier to seem that I have a gun to my head and that's why I had to fall into this decision. Whereas what the Lubavitcher Rebbe is saying is, you chose to be here, you can choose to be somewhere else. Ultimately, the environment ourselves is where we choose, and that will influence the decisions we make later on as well. There's a lot to think about when it comes to the environments we choose. And I'd like to flip it to the other side now for a moment. Because up to now, this is like a little bit depressing in a sense, right? Because, we try the best we can, and some environments are better, some environments are less better. And sometimes we look back regretfully, we look back and we realize that the environment was not good for us in general. And sometimes we don't have a choice, like the Rambam says, to leave those environments necessarily. But there's a positive side to it as well. And I'd like to quote a Gemara, which sounds like it's at complete opposite odds with what we just learned beforehand, just to turn it around 180 degrees. The Gemara is in Yuma, and it's describing what is a Baal Teshuva, a person who is really a person who's done full Teshuva. Now, Actually, just this last week, Rabbi Ari Khan came to our shul, and if you had an opportunity of learning, we have the recording available. He did a really beautiful shir, really, really beautiful shir on the topic of the teshuva of Reish Lakish, of Reish Lakish's, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish's process of teshuva. And he made a very, I think, poignant observation, just in general, in passing, is that we use the term Baal Teshuva incorrectly today, right? Baal Teshuva is a person who's doing an Avera, who's doing something, transgressing, and then decides to come clean and move away from doing that Avera. He says, what we call Baal Teshuva today is not a process of Baal Teshuva, it's a process of education. Most people did not have access to authentic Judaism, and now they are becoming more educated Jews. That's what's happening over here. They weren't actively doing Averos. They didn't know any better, as an example. So the term Baal Teshuva, and moreover, he says that Baal Teshuva should be a limited scope, meaning, let's say a person's doing something bad intentionally, right? And they stop doing it, they're a Baal Teshuva. But then, after they finish being a Baal Teshuva, now they should they graduate that term. They shouldn't be a Baal Teshuva the rest of their lives. I mean, like, it's a funny term and label that we've created. It's worthwhile thinking about that for a moment. But let's talk about a Baal Teshuva in the sense of a person who's actively and within education doing an Avera, right? So Gemara says that how do you get to a full level of accomplishment of Baal Teshuva? So the Gemara says, a really shocking statement. And the Rambam quotes this in Hilchos Teshuva. What is a Baal Teshuva Gemara? So the Gemara gives one suggestion: Heki Dabi Baal Teshuva, Amar Yehuda, Kogon Shabaz, Aver Liyodo, Pam Rishon, Veshnia, Venitzal Mimeno. That person encounters the same Avera once or twice, and then is saved from it. Okay, but the Gemara then says, again, this is focused on a man in this particular case. Machavi Rav Yehuda, Rav Yehuda would indicate the following situation: Ba'oisa Isha, Ba'oisa Perek, Ba'oisa Makom. Let's say we're referring to a immoral relationship, right? So a person transgressed, a man in this particular case that's focused on transgressed, and that man finds himself in the same relationship, the same person that he was with, in the same time, so to speak, of their lives, meaning to say when they are still young, vibrant, and involved in these things in the same way, and ba'osa makom, and the same place. Which means to say it's not that because of circumstance that now, you know, 70 years later, right, you know, congratulations, right, you know, you're able to desist. That's not the Teshuvah Gemurah. Teshuvah Gemurah is Ba'oisa Isha, Ba'oisa Perek, Ba'oisa Zmach, and we can broaden this, not from focusing on an immoral sin, but let's talk about something more, shaveh lechol nefesh. But let's say lashon hara, that you have a walking partner, and every day in the morning you speak lashon hara with that walking partner, and then you decide one day that I'm going to go with the same walking partner in the same place after the latest communal catastrophe, and I'm not going to talk about it, and I'm not going to blame everybody for what just happened, and I'm so to speak utilizing the teshuva gemara. That's sort of what the gemara is saying. Here's the interesting thing. Rav Yonasan Abishitz, in commenting this Gemara, says, he says, why the place? Meaning to say, like, I understand the same person, the same context, but the place? Like, why is the place, the room, the space, the walking, why is that relevant? He says, we don't appreciate that in an environment that we put ourselves, and we do something negative or positive in that environment, we are influencing that environment as well. And when we sin, we influence that environment, we've tarnished that environment itself. That environment requires fixing as well. So it's not just about me, it's about the environment that I need to be, so to speak, pulling up from the dent that I made in it as well. That's a very powerful statement. In fact, he quotes the Pasuk in Habakkuk, which says, "Ki even mikir titzak," the walls, the stones of the place will call out for the good and the bad. They will report upon ourselves what we did in those places. And I was thinking about this for the good, you know, for a moment. I remember that in Keren B'Yavne, the Rosh Hashiva was Rav Chaim Yaakov Goldwich. That's Rav Goldwich's uncle, Rav Meir Goldwich's uncle, who was the Rosh Hashiva. He left the world of the yeshivas, of the Lithuanian yeshivas, to start the first Hesder yeshiva in history, because he realized that there were many, many young men who were going to need to go to the army, and if they didn't have a yeshiva education, there would be nothing for them. And he set up the first Hesder yeshiva. All the rest came afterwards. And he suffered from leaving that world in many ways. But he was very much a pioneer, bridging both worlds. And he used to say to the young men in the yeshiva, it's very nice and it's beautiful in Keren B'Yavne. There's palm trees and it's gorgeous. It's a lovely, lovely environment. And sometimes they have these young men outside, their shtenders out in the shade, and it's picturesque, you know. He says, it's a beautiful thing. He says, but you should know the walls of the yeshiva have 50 plus years of Torah imbued in them, right? He says, it's important to learn in an environment where Evan Mikir Yitzhak, where the stones are calling out imbued with the holiness of them. And I was thinking about this recently because we've just been blessed to put in new carpets, which is so beautiful. It's magnificent. And it took a lot of effort, a lot of work, a lot of the hands of a lot of people. I just posted the other week, last week, that there was a special spot in the shul where on the right hand or the left hand side of the bimah, there's like a little spot where there was all the stains on the kiddush for 30 years of kiddush for the kids on Friday night. You know, wow. You can't underestimate the power of what went into those carpets, which means that we have a new responsibility, folks. When we're davening in that shul, we got a lot of tefillah to put into those carpets. It's all fresh. It's uncharted terrain in terms of spirituality as well. But what Rav Yonasan Abishitz is essentially saying is, don't forget the impact on the environment. A part of the Chua process is fixing the environment itself. So much so that he suggests that that's why it is. This is a very remarkable idea. He says that when we do teshuva, we have Rosh Hashanah and we have Yom Kippur, and we're sitting there and we're talking about teshuva, and we want to be better, and we're trying to chart a new path, and we don't want to be coming around the tree to the same point again. Like in many times, unfortunately, we feel like we're really back to point A. And he says, after that whole process of teshuva, then we go do sukkos. And many of the Balei Machshava say that sukkos itself is part of the teshuva process, the teshuva me'ava part of the process. He says, why is that? He says, because we fixed our bodies, meaning we fixed our persona, but we haven't fixed our place. And so what do? We exile ourselves from our place, our homes, in which there was all kinds of things that perhaps were less than best. And what do? We leave that so that that has a space. We now fix a temporary dwelling where we fix ourselves, and then we go back to our houses again, refreshed. It's the process of fixing of our space as well, to appreciate the impact we have on our environment. Not so much the environment has on us, but we are in the environment. Now, you may say, but wait a second, this seems to be in direct conflict So what we learned before, and the Gemara in Baba Basra says that if there are two paths, right, and one path is less than the perfect path for a man in this particular case, right, and the person should be going there, and he decides he's going to go along that route, then that's called a rasha. But here we say in the Gemara, what's about to shuv a Gemara? A person, but I say makom, the same place. So wait a second. So let's say there was this guy who used to always go along the laundry path. That was his, entertainment, and that was his. He liked to go laundry watching, and for many, many years. And then he decides that this is really morally corrupt. This is bad for me. It's not appropriate. It's immodest. And he decides he wants to fix himself. Right. So does he go by the rule of Ba'osa Makom? Should he go back with a blindfold, and go along that route? Is that what the Gemara is really recommending?
I would say no. He shouldn't put himself. Should he encounter?
If he encounters,
exercise self-control. Then it's
good. So one answer is maybe it depends on if the person comes up with that circumstance, like Dr. Yeager was saying. Another suggestion that comes up, and I was actually discussing this yesterday with a few people, because we learned this yesterday in the ladies' share. And actually Marjorie said a very beautiful idea. I think this is to her credit, I think she's right, is it may also depend on the circumstance, the environment itself. Meaning, you don't need to purify the disco club. Do you know what I'm saying? That doesn't need to be fixed, because that by itself is a place which has got complications. It's not your responsibility. But your Shabbos table is. Meaning, if my Shabbos table is a place of conversation about people rather than ideas, right? So that's what the default conversation is. I need to come to Ba'os Makom. I need to come back to that place and ensure that where it's my Shabbos table, my train ride, my chevrus, or wherever else it is in my life that is worthy of being better, I should make better. That's the environmental fix. But there are certain places that we're not supposed to be putting ourselves back into, which are perhaps environments which are not where we should not be in. This is worthwhile thinking in terms of the places that we're in. But I'd like to close perhaps with one statement. This is, by the way, I think is what the Gemara means. The Gemara says in Brachos, "B'makom shebalei tshuva omdim ein tzadikim yachalim lamod." Do you notice that the Gemara says, "B'makom shebalei tshuva omdim"? The place that they decided to fix, and a person who went through a complicated situation and now has fixed that place, nobody can access that place because of what they did to fix the environment.
And means the topic may not have been subjected to that
good
environmental challenge.
Exactly, and that might mean there's a negative, we'll call shadow to that statement as well. I'm going to just close with perhaps the following episode, which I heard a number of years ago from a very special person, Mayor Levine, for those of you who know Mayor and Jenny. Anyway, so Mayor told me this story, that a very special story that occurred in Tel Aviv many, many years ago. It was in the older area of Tel Aviv, where it had once been an up and coming neighborhood, and it was less of an up and coming neighborhood now. And there was a little shtibble, and it was kind of obviously not frequented by so many people because that wasn't the context right now. And, a few elderly men were holding together the minimum as they possibly could. And one Tuesday afternoon, they're short a tenth to make Mincha Maariv. And so, there's a fellow on the street, he's looking around, he's looking for the minion. And down the street walks this fellow, with his guitar on his back, his hair down to his belt, he's on his way to the beach. Right, so this fellow is coming up to him and he says, "Please, Adoni, we just need a minyan. If you wouldn't mind just saying that." And the guy's like, "I have no interest in this antiquated business." So he says, "No, please, just 10, it's 15 minutes. We'll do it very quickly. All you need to do is sit the back. We just need you to do this." And after a number of minutes of heckling, he says, "Look, it's going to take me less time just to sit at the back and then to have to deal with this nonsense." So that's what he does. He walks and he sits at the back while they do their thing. And he's looking around. He's an intelligent fellow. He's an educated individual. And he happens to speak Hebrew. So there's a lot of books in Hebrew on the shelf. So he pulls out a book to read while they're doing their thing. Interesting. So he puts it back and that's it. Then anyway, so next Tuesday afternoon, guess what? Guess he's walking down the street and guess who's missing the 10th man. So so they meet again. And this time he's a little less apprehensive about going in, okay. And he takes the same book off the shelf and carries on reading where he left off. He reads a little bit and this becomes his Tuesday afternoon practice. And slowly but surely, he has lots of questions. The more questions he has, the more books he reads. The more books he reads, the more brainwashed he becomes. and he makes the decision. He's slowly in the process. Gemara says of Chazar Abitruva, and he returns to Judaism. So his dad, let's call him right now Durek, you know, is sitting in a bar a few months later with his friends, and they're commiserating. And his friends were saying to him, "Oh, Durek, what happened? The best of education, you know, you put him on all the right sports teams. You got him involved in all the youth movements, and look what happened to him. Nebuch, he's become this close-minded, you know, dati, like, you know, fanatic who's, you know, like davening every day, you know." And so, like, what's going on? And the fellow says, "You know, I have to tell you, I don't know what happened, and you know, I tried my best, but I will tell you a little secret, and that is that when my father came from Eastern Europe and he decided to come and he came to Tel Aviv, he settled over here when it was a very new city at the time, and he perhaps had a different lifestyle than I had chosen for myself. But I want you to know that he was the one who established this shtibble. He was the person who was instrumental in starting this." And I always think about the story so much, because let's reverse into the story for a second. That grandfather came from Eastern Europe, and he probably had certain aspirations for his children and his grandchildren, and they didn't happen, right? For whatever reason, his children were not interested in drinking the Kool-Aid that he was drinking, and he probably davened very, very hard for his children. And you know what? He died not seeing any dreams fulfilled. He died having left Europe, not being able to continue it, and yes, he had healthy children established the state of Israel, that's wonderful, but not living the same tradition as him. But the place, the stones did not forget. And there was a davening that there was a certain tefillah there that it would be the place that his grandson would once walk into, have the right space. So it's important to appreciate on both sides. Number one is it's not that we are absolved of any free will in because of the environment we're in. The exercising of free will is the environment we choose to put ourselves in. And we can choose to put ourselves in, and we can choose to put ourselves out. But once we are in, and sometimes and many times we are found in imperfect environments, let's not forget the impact we have on elevating that environment. And if we actually degenerated that environment, of fixing that environment they're in as well. There's a lot to appreciate in this particular subject. I think for ourselves, there's many decisions. I know for myself that reflect these decisions. Thank you, everybody, very much for taking the time today.